Hi, Jenna's here.
Hi, Jenna. It's Richie. It's just you and I on the line so far.
Okay, great. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good.
How are you doing?
Good. I'm in Boston this week, and I grew up out here, so it's always nice to be back.
Oh, good. I lived in Boston for a little while. It was a very fun time for me. I actually played more golf in Boston than I did back down here in D.C.
It was a good time.
Yeah. Hi, did someone just join?
Yes, it's Chris.
Hi, Chris. You heard Jenna and I reminiscing about Boston, and she grew up there, and I miss it. Okay. How you doing, Chris?
Good. Yeah, I actually I spent 2.5 months in Boston for an exec ed program, and I love Boston. The city's great.
Yeah, I'm biased. Having grown up here, I'm lucky to be back this week.
I did.
Hey, Rich, this is Steve. I'm going to mute because it's really noisy here.
That's great. Thanks.
You've got Susan, too.
Hi, Susan. Susan, are you still down
in... This is going to be me, I think, from the NBTL. I don't think Gomathi can join us today.
Perfect. Susan or Chris, did you guys have anyone else from your team that you think would be joining?
No.
Yeah, it's just me on my end.
Perfect.
And if there are kind of things that we can't address or answer, I can definitely, you know, circle back with the BG team or put you guys in contact with the BG team.
Well, with you and Susan, I'm pretty sure that we can get a good answer from all these questions here. If there, you know, are some spin-off questions or things that, you know, we uncover that we need some additional follow-up on, I think that's great, and thank you for that offer. But yeah, hopefully we'll have a good chat here, and I think we should be able to cover everything. So I appreciate you guys joining us here. We've had a few of these now, and it's a little different than your experience, Chris, with GMI in the past. But just before we get started, Chris or Susan, just for Jenna's sake, she is on the DNVGL team and is there. She's helping us craft some of the messaging around some of these insights that we're learning in GMI. Would it be helpful just for a really high-level overview of kind of the work that you do at Exelon or specifically with PG&E of how it might relate to the EV Smart program here? It might just help just for a little bit of background from you guys. Just to get started.
Yeah, sure. So my role within Exelon is I'm part of Exelon Utilities, which is kind of a support organization or an umbrella organization, however you want to describe it, that focuses solely on the regulated business. So I work directly with each of our operating companies to develop policy and support policy initiatives across the fleet of our regulated utilities. As it relates specifically to EVs, I probably spent the better part of the last 3 years working very closely with all the different opcos in terms of developing their EV programs, their policy objectives, and anything that was associated with any, you know, EVs or mobility or transportation electrification efforts that they had underway or that we were looking to embark on in each of the jurisdictions. As it relates specifically to our Maryland programs, the EV Smart programs, I was part of the working group that evaluated the different program options and objectives through PC 44. That started back in January of 2018. And was with the working group all the way up through the filing that was made the filing was made in January of 2018. We started working on it well before that. And then we got a commission order in January of 2019. And so I've really stayed close to the folks in Maryland in terms of their program implementation and design, one, to ensure it kind of it meets the objectives that we had laid out in the filing, and then also just to make sure that we're carrying lessons learned over to our other utilities who are engaging in or embarking upon, you know, a transportation electrification program in their own respective jurisdictions.
Great.
Perfect.
That's really helpful. Thank you.
But I really don't have much to add to that. I mean, Chris is much closer to the EV work that's being done across, you know, in terms of the strategy in Exelon Utilities and then across its application across the various OPCOs. My role is more on this call is more from a GridWise Alliance. I'm on the GridWise Alliance board, and I am the lead on the policy council for GridWise Alliance, and also had a hand in writing the EV paper that GridWise Alliance issued last year. So I look at it much more from, you know, where Chris gets very involved in the individual application of programs in our jurisdictions. I look at more broadly from what's the political perspective and what needs to be, you know, what do we need to do with stakeholders and others to advance an environment in which robust utility investment in EV, you know, in electrification of transportation can move forward. So Chris is definitely more your EV expert on this stuff. I'm more of a policy, political person, you know, just trying to set the right tone for things moving forward.
Great. That's helpful, too.
And so I appreciate it. Thank you both for doing that, and I think that that's a great kind of setup here. Jenna, any kind of just light background on your end or introduction?
Sure. I'll be super quick. So Michelle Tiami from DMVCL is on the GridWise Alliance board, and I offered to help her and to help GridWise Alliance create the GMI report for this year. So at DNVGL, I'm the Transportation Electrification Lead for North America.
Okay. Excellent.
So I think that that's a great place, and thank you, everybody, for that kind of start off. And where I want to pick up here, and Susan, to your point, on kind of setting the stage and really talking about insights, that's really what this conversation here is about. And Chris, in your background of working with the GMI through different phases, and Susan, you as well, you'll notice that this year we're not asking for additional data. We're not re-ranking states. We are not really getting into the scoring so much, and we are looking to tell the stories that are happening in 2018 and 2019, and trying to glean insights, and to your point, Susan, trying to write a more of a report that assesses where we are now and talks more about where are we going and how does the work that's being done on the grid and the different factors that are kind of relating to, for this example, electrification of transportation, you know, what does it mean? And I think in the GMI, we've done a pretty good job of capturing kind of here's some policies at a state level and here's some data on some things that are happening on the grid. But I don't think we've told the whole story of how it's changing, where it's changing quickly, and what does it mean. And so what we're doing here today is to really set the stage of, you know, what are some of the activities that our utilities are doing? And for this example, it's on EVs. We're talking with other utilities about resiliency. Even this afternoon, we're talking with CenterPoint Energy. How can we help shape the conversation of the pace of change and what our utilities are defining as the pace of acceleration around grid-related activities? So that's really the purpose here, is to try to get a little bit more detail about this project, but also, you know, while we have the time here, is to, you know, talk about other you know, topics or trends that you guys are finding, you know, as important. And so really what we're trying to do, Susan, is take the next step in that EVs white paper. There's some insights that are gleaned there. Let's see if we can update those. Let's see if there are things that need to be changed. And so the first section of the GMI will be kind of setting the stage on these trends and topics. The second part is really talking about what our utilities and what our members are doing about them. And the third part will be, what are the insights? What does it all mean? And so, Susan, I would assume that you would have a hand in that third part. So we don't need to get to all that today, but we really want to get more information out of you guys about this project. And I'll stop there. But, you know, before we get into the ED Smart program, Chris or Susan, is there any questions just about, you know, general GMI development or about this conversation that you had before we got started?
I think I'm good.
I'm good.
Okay. I will say that I'm recording this call. It's just for playback so that we, in case we get a quote or something that is that we need to go back and double check, it will not be distributed anywhere outside of this group plus just the two other board members that are helping us out, Michelle, Steve Callahan from GridBright, and Ronnie Sandoval, who's consulting right now, is working with us. So that's the only people that will hear this at most, and then it will be destroyed. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay.
So with that, Jenna, do you want to kick us off here and get into the questions?
Sure, happy to. So I know Richie included the questions in the email invitation that went around. So those are the – we're just going to kind of go through those one by one. And if there's something else that you think is important as we go through this that maybe we left out, we can circle back on that too.
Okay.
So the first question just asked for a little bit of additional background regarding BG's transportation electrification strategy and sort of how this specific EV Smart project fits into that strategy.
So I think that across all of our utilities, we have a much broader electrification effort that's underway, or I should say beneficial electrification underway. Transportation is just one small sliver of that overall beneficial electrification program for each of our utilities. I think what drives us in the, you know, electrification of the transportation sector is really our desire to drive down greenhouse gases and carbon emissions. You know, as you guys probably well know, that, you know, the transportation sector is now the largest emitter of greenhouse gas and carbon, and it now surpasses the, you know, the generation business that we have on the competitive side here. So the transportation area is fits within our strategy in a number of different ways. Again, one, it fits within this broader beneficial electrification initiative that we have underway. I think secondly, it fits into our mindset of trying to be innovative and forward thinking. And delivering technology or technologically related services and products to our customers. And then I also think that it does touch on our strategy and vision within the utilities, which is our overall strategy and vision around connected communities. And transportation and mobility are key to connected communities and our customers being able to do, you know, a number of different things within those communities by having different modes or different means of clean transportation available to them.
Okay, great. Susan, did you have anything to add? Sounds like no.
No, and I'm on mute.
Can you say a little?
So.
Oh, I figured. No worries.
I'm sorry. Take it as no. Okay. I'll speak
okay,
up when
no
I got
problem.
Mad.
Okay, that sounds great.
I mean, and I would just maybe I'll add one thing is that specific to Maryland, there was a PC 44 proceeding that was initiated by the commission. That PC 44 initiative identified six different work streams that needed to be addressed, and EVs were one of the six work streams that were identified by the commission. Obviously, we were very supportive of it in terms of that being one of the focal points or one of the focused work streams. And in that work stream, the working group was asked to present a program, you know, centered around the number of different areas or opportunities as it relates to EVs and transportation and mobility, and deliver a program or proposal to the commission. So that kind of was what was the mechanism that got this forward in front of the commission. Absent that, you know, looking back on it, it may have been a lot more challenging. As challenging as this was at times, it may have been a lot more challenging for us to go in with a separate filing supporting EVs, because the sheer fact that the commission identified it as one of the work streams in PC 44, you know, was the signal to, you know, stakeholders that this was an important area that they were focused on and wanted to move forward on this front.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And with that, so you were talking about that a little bit earlier, I'm not as familiar with the preceding numbers. So this was the one that started in 2018, and then ultimately the commission approved sort of a modified version of that original proposal, and that was for 5,000 chargers across a number of utilities, and I think 500 for BGE.
Yeah, so it actually started before that. I think it was towards the end of 2016
okay.
where the commission issued the order for PC 44 and identified the different work streams. And then the work group started working shortly thereafter, met a number of times throughout the course of the year, and then filed its proposal in 2018 or at the beginning of 2018. And then we did not get our order from the commission until January of 2019. And the program went live on July 1st, 2019.
Okay. That's really helpful. Thank you. Okay, so, you know, still on the transportation electrification topic, there's a question here about characterizing the major challenges and opportunities that it poses. So maybe let's start with the challenges from your perspective posed by transportation electrification, just either in general and as well as for your customers at BG&E.
Well, I think some of the challenges when you look at it from, you know, a light duty perspective, and that's what our programs right now are focused on is the light duty vehicle
mm-hmm.
market. And so I think the couple of things that come to mind in terms of challenges or how we like to think about them are barriers to entry. One, we think total cost of ownership is a barrier to entry. People have a perception that these vehicles are higher priced than ICE vehicles, but over the long term, you know, and as battery prices continue to decline, the total cost of ownership, you know, which includes your ongoing maintenance, your fueling, you know, all the different things that you have with a traditional ICE vehicle that you don't have with an electric vehicle, the EVs are pretty much at or on par with ICE vehicles at this point. And that's just going to continue to get better as battery prices decline.
Mm-hmm.
I think the second thing is probably a lack of publicly available infrastructure. Range anxiety is typically cited as, you know, one of the biggest reasons, if not the biggest reason, as to why people aren't adopting these vehicles or is the reason why they're hesitant to adopt these vehicles. You know, the thought is, hey, I buy this, and you know, if I don't have, you know, dedicated charging at my home, where do I charge it, you know, on my way to work on a daily basis, and then also if I'm going to take longer trips. So range anxiety is another challenge. I think that is beginning
mm-hmm.
to, you know, dissipate to some degree. One, battery ranges are getting much longer or, you know, greater durations on the batteries. And then secondly, you're starting to see programs like EV Smart, you know, both from the utility and from the competitive marketplace, where they're starting to fill that gap or starting to fill those gaps to some degree. But we're nowhere near where we need to be or should be from a public charging perspective. And then
mm-hmm.
I think the last one is really just a lack of education. I think when you look at some of the numbers or, you know, anecdotally, you know, even in California, which has the highest penetration rates of electric vehicles, it's still something like almost 50% of people in California can't name one EV or identify an electric
mm-hmm.
vehicle. So there's just a general lack of education.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
And so maybe to your, to this question directly, where we see an opportunity, our programs or our program design was really focused on how we as the utility can reduce or mitigate some of those barriers to entry. You know, there's some things that we as the utility just aren't going to be able to do in terms of, you know, from a technology perspective or battery technology perspective. We do make some investments on the non-regulated side of the business in those types of things, but from a utility perspective directly, you know, as we look at total cost of ownership, that is helping our customers with lowering the cost of the total cost of the vehicles. We do that through rate design. So we're making the fuel source, you know, cheaper or less expensive, and encouraging our folks to, you know, charge at ideal times on the grid. We also have a number of programs that we have discounts with either an OEM or some of the EVSC equipment manufacturers for our customers, and we pass those discounts along to our customers. And then from an infrastructure perspective, obviously, you know, again, we think that there needs to be more publicly available charging. We've gone after that in a number of different ways, whether that's through utility ownership and operation, all the way down through, you know, providing rebates to residential customers for installing smart L2 chargers at their home. And then obviously, we think we can make a difference when it comes to education and outreach. And so we've developed a number of different tools and programs to help promote, you know, what we're trying to do with EV Smart, but also trying to promote and raise just general awareness of electric vehicles.
Okay, great. So the opportunity from your perspective is really the reduction or elimination of the barriers to entry. So that's
exactly
a way to sort of sum up. Okay, awesome. That's great.
Yeah. And the other way, too, that we've thought about our programs and how we continue to think about our programs is as these vehicles come onto the grid, how do we minimize the impact of that load that's coming onto the grid? And then also maximizing the benefits of that incremental load that comes onto the system or is a result of, you know, EVs in our service territories. So that's another angle or aspect that we definitely pay very close attention to and give a lot of thought to.
Would you characterize that as a challenge or an opportunity or a little bit of both?
I think it's both. I think what I would tell you on the challenge side, at least right now, because penetration rates are low or lower, we're not seeing as much, you know, system-wide impacts. Now, we may see some isolated pockets on individual feeders or things along those lines, but we just haven't reached critical mass where you're going to potentially start to see significant impacts on the system as a whole. But then again, even now at low penetration rates, it is still creating opportunities for us from an infrastructure perspective and then also from a rate design perspective. And when you kind of take the combination of a couple of different things with that incremental load that's on the system now, it does have the potential or the ability to lower overall rates for all of our customers. So both EV drivers and non-EV drivers benefit from this incremental load coming onto the system.
Yeah, I think that's an important point.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, my little fingers are just catching up with the notes here. Okay. So the next question really to, you know, going back to the EV Smart program, you know, given that there's sort of countless ways that you could engage in supporting transportation electrification, why was this specific method of engagement? Why did you land on that, on this program?
Yeah, so I would tell you that we internally, we spent a lot of time and gave a lot of thought to what our program design should look like for our utilities as they pursue this. And we kind of landed on a couple of different areas. One was infrastructure. The second was rate design. The third was education and outreach or stakeholder engagement. And then the fourth bucket was innovation and technology. And so the reason why we landed on those is because they all are able to help us meet our objective, again, from a grid perspective, you know, minimizing the impact on the grid and maximizing the benefit, and then also from a customer perspective, because we felt like there were a number of different ways that we wanted to address the market. One size isn't necessarily going to fit all. And also, too, as the industry, you know, continues to mature, we still think it's at a stage, especially when you think about infrastructure, that, you know, one business model doesn't necessarily fit, or we don't know what is the best or what's going to be the winner. So when we looked at our infrastructure programs, you know, like I said before, we're doing We're doing utility own and operate in some situations. We're also providing rebates on make ready work for different use cases. And then we're also offering rebates to residential customers to install smart level 2 charging. And, you know, again, there's a lot of thought behind why we would, you know, advocate for each one of those models, and there's various reasons. Again, and a lot of those do support, you know, kind of the objectives of minimizing grid impact, maximizing benefit, and then also, you know, offering a wide variety of options to the customers. And then we thought rate design was really important for us to pursue because, again, we want to provide the right signals or the right incentives for customers to charge at the most appropriate times. Or, you know, another way to think about it is that provide them with price signals that enable them to control their usage and control their cost that's associated with, you know, charging their vehicles and have, you know, good visibility into, you know, what it's going to cost them if they charge at this time of day or if they charge in this specific location or this type of charging. Also, I'll go back to infrastructure, too, just to comment on that for a second, which I think is important to understand, too, is that as we think about our programs, you know, we think about this through the lens of social equity and social justice, and we want to make sure that this technology gets to all of our customers, not just, you know, early adopters or the ones who are most able to afford the technology today. We want to make sure, again, that that is, you know, all of our customers have the access to the technology so that they can, you know, derive the benefits from, you know, this particular technology. And there are just, from an infrastructure perspective, we think that there are just segments of the market that the competitive EVSE companies aren't going to want to address or aren't going to want to play in. And so that was part of our thinking and consideration as we thought through our, you know, utility-owned and operate piece of the infrastructure program. And then, you know, I mentioned education and outreach as, you know, that is clearly a barrier to entry. So we have some programs that we're able to fund through, you know, EV Smart that provide customers with more education, basic general understanding of what an EV is, what the benefits of EVs are, and, you know, give them some ideas as to here's the different types of makes and models that exist in the market today. Yeah, obviously, we're doing some ride and drive programs. We're also doing some things just in terms of, you know, marketing our own programs so that customers are aware of the rebates and incentives that we provide. And then the last piece is really technology and innovation. Unfortunately, that aspect of the program in Maryland was denied by the commission, but what we're really looking to do is invite folks to come in and come up with innovative technology-driven solutions for some segments of our customers that would help improve their access and use of electrified transportation. A lot of it was targeted around low to moderate income neighborhoods or disadvantaged communities here in the state.
Would you have a good understanding of why that component was denied?
I think that part of it was that the commission was trying to keep costs down on this program in general. You know, we filed for a program that was in excess of $100 million. At the end of the day, I think the total program size is probably closer to $30 to $40 million in the end. So there was definitely a conscious decision by the commission to scale the program back, one, to manage costs, and then also just to do this in a way that we weren't getting too far out over our skis and really kind of, I don't want to say dipping our toe in the water, but that's what I've heard some of the folks from the commission kind of refer to it as, is really kind of taking a slower approach rather than jumping in wholeheartedly. And then with that, with the technology and the innovation funding that we were going to provide, you know, we were directed that there are other avenues or other areas where funds or dollars are available for us to apply to those types of applications. And so we were encouraged to, you know, work with some of the other organizations in the state to help, you know, fund and develop some of those programs rather than it being directly supported by our customers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. Okay. Okay, so thinking again about EV Smart, how are you defining success for that project? Are there specific metrics that you're tracking and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, some of the easy metrics are, like, for example, with the utility owned and operated program, you know, want to reach our goal of installing, you know, the 850 charging stations that we'll own and operate. You know, we've got 1,000 residential rebates for each of our utilities that we're allowed to offer. So it's really tracking against those types of metrics. I will tell you the one thing that we were very careful about, you know, as we worked with the commission on developing the program and then ultimately getting approval is we really can't make the direct linkage between our programs and someone going out to buy an EV.
Mm-hmm.
As you mm-hmm. probably know, Maryland is a ZEV state. They have a goal of 300,000 EVs by 2025. We kept getting that question a lot from the bench during, you know, our conversations with them around the program, you know, in terms of, hey, if we do this, how many cars are you going to promise us? And that's just a bridge too far because, as you well know, buying decisions are not highly correlated to sometimes rational things when people mm-hmm. buy vehicles or a car. And, again, it's just very difficult for us to link or make kind of that one-to-one relationship between, hey, this element of a program got you to go out and buy an EV. So what our program is meant to do is seed the market, and it's meant to be complementary to the other efforts that are going on, whether they are efforts that are being undertaken by the state agencies or efforts that are being undertaken by the competitive EVSC companies.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Okay, and so you won't be required to sort of make that direct linkage between the programs and the customer decision. It's
yeah.
more like contributing
yeah,
to the broader
yeah.
marketplace. Mm-hmm.
No, we're not being asked
okay.
to do that. A lot of the data and the information that we're providing is just the program, you know, tracking of the program costs, tracking of program milestones in terms of, you know, number of charging installations or rebates, that we're providing to customers. And then we do have to provide customer data and report that back to the commission as part of our program on the residential side.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, and then just sort of for you, is success with the program, you know, fully reaching the goal of installing all the charging stations and going through all of the rebates, or is there another way that you're sort of defining success?
Well, I would tell you that I think part of the success was us being able to get an order from the commission.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I say that's a major success for us is that because despite the fact that we were scaled back in terms of the size and the dollar amount of the program, I think that we really have established very good policy and very good precedent in the state of Maryland that will
mm-hmm.
enable us to build on this initial light-duty vehicle program. And whether that's expanding the light-duty vehicle program as the market continues to grow, or more importantly, as we're starting to think about now, is how do we take some of what we're doing on the light-duty side and some of the precedent that we got for light-duty vehicles and applying that to medium and heavy-duty vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be remiss if I didn't declare some success just by implementing the initial program or getting the order to implement the initial program. But I think longer term, you know, clearly it's going to be, you know, are we hitting the number of, you know, charging stations that we need to install over the course of the five-year program? You know, the number of rebates that we're offering, incentives that we're offering. I think, you know, that's simplistic success. I think it's a little bit harder to define, you know, some of the other successes that we're hoping to get out of this because, you know, broadly and generally speaking, we're looking to grow adoption and uses of electric vehicles. And that's a little bit more nebulous, if you will, to be able to kind of say, hey, we're responsible for this directly or one-for-one. But, again, we think our programs are going to have a meaningful impact.
Okay, great. Okay, so given that this has been live since July, what are you learning so far from the project and learning, you know, really broadly, right? Learning about your customers, your team, the market, partners, market actors, anything like that, and then with a maybe specific focus on anything you've learned that surprised you.
Well, I would tell you that I think that one thing that continues to surprise us is that the technology continues to mature and evolve. And so you hear a lot of stories from other folks about, you know, certain companies or certain technologies can do X, Y, and Z. But then when you start to kind of scratch the surface a little bit or get an RFP with some of those vendors and suppliers, you kind of realize that, well, it's a maybe. It's not necessarily a yes. So it did take us a while to develop the RFPs for the type of equipment that we were looking for, because again, there was a lot of back and forth between us and the vendors trying to just understand some of the basics or what we thought were some of the basics at that point. I think what we're learning from our customers is that, at least with the utility owned and operated, is there's an initial excitement and euphoria for them to, you know, have these charging stations installed on their property or at their locations.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge we're having a little bit is that there really isn't a central point of contact, and there's not a lot of understanding or education around what it takes, you know, to install the charging station from start to finish. So as you can well imagine, we're talking to the real estate people, then we're talking to the environmental people, and, you know, maybe a couple of other different people, and those aren't necessarily the people that were the ones who put in the request or were supportive of the request. That may have come from somewhere else within, you know, a state government or a municipality. So that's a little bit of a challenge right now, is, you know, working with the customers to kind of walk them through all the things that we need from them and having them fill out the applications and go through the process to have the charging stations installed.
Okay, that makes sense. So maybe it sounds like the learning there is that the chain is maybe the wrong word, but the number of entities involved in sort of the process from decision to go to installation is that there's a lot of them, and that maybe they're not as coordinated at the customer end as they could be.
Yeah, because this is new for them to install this type of equipment on their property, something they've never had to deal with. And they're asking us a lot of questions like, well, are these going to get used? When are they going to get used? Who's going to be using them? Just, you know, again, basic understanding. So I think really the lesson learned or the message is that it's, you know, early engagement, it's often engagement, and then just understanding the internal decision makers or the folks who are the ones who are going to be the ones that help us kind of manage the process or mitigate all or manage the different things that we need to do at each one of these customer locations.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Okay, right. So the person responsible for implementing the decision isn't always the one who's making the decision, and just stringing those pieces together is tricky.
Yep.
Okay, great. Okay, so given all of this, what do you think are the three most important things other utilities should know or should do before they start engaging in EV projects or transportation electrification projects?
Yeah, I think first and foremost is that I think there should be an internal commitment to, you know, beneficial electrification or transportation electrification. This shouldn't be a side project or something that an organization is kind of saying, well, you know, we've got a lot of areas that we're focused on. This can kind of be a side project that we'll work on. No, I definitely think it needs to have executive-level support within the organization. I think that's one thing that's really helped our utilities is that, you know, the championing of the message and the cause is coming from the top, and there's a lot of support that's been provided to each of these organizations in terms of, you know, dollars, resources, and, you know, a number of other things that clearly have helped us I've seen other companies, again, that they kind of have gone about this as like a side project, or it's just, you know, something they're doing because everybody else is. There just needs to be a real internal commitment from the beginning on this. I think the other thing that is extremely important is that you need to engage with your stakeholders. And, you know, in this arena, there's multiple stakeholders. And that's one of the things I think we've learned along the way is that, you know, we're not only dealing with our regulators, which is a typical stakeholder for us as a utility to deal with, but we're dealing with EVSE companies, we're dealing with auto OEMs, we're dealing with environmental groups, we're dealing with different types of customers, whether they're residential or commercial or government or municipalities. The point is that there's a whole host of vested stakeholders that really need to work together and work in conjunction with each other to really plan this out and look at this over a long-term perspective and kind of have, you know, a North Star, if you will, that we're all working towards. Because if it's done in isolation and it's done in other pockets, it's just not going to provide a really premium or seamless customer experience. It's going to be disjointed and fragmented.
Okay, so internal commitment, growth over simplification, but internal commitment, stakeholder engagement. Is there anything else you think is sort of vitally important for utilities to do before they start on transportation electrification?
Yeah, I mean, it probably kind of fits into, well, what I would tell you, what I would say is that if you're just getting underway, that, you know, talk to the people who have gone through this. There's a lot of us who have, you know, some scars and some battle wounds from the stakeholder process and going through, you know, the approval of individual programs, and then, you know, onto the part of actually executing and implementing on a program. You know, there's a lot of folks who have done a lot of good work in this space, who've got a lot of good ideas. And again, back to my, you know, commentary around the technology is evolving pretty rapidly, and regulation is obviously having trouble keeping pace with that. But just in terms of there's resources out there, leverage those resources, talk to people who've been through this before. There's a number of, you know, organizations, including GridWise Alliance, EEI, the Alliance for Transportation Electrification. They are great resources. For people who are just starting to think about this or just starting to go through it, you really should leverage those resources and the work that others have done up to this point.
Fantastic. Okay, that's great. That's really the questions that we had sort of scripted for the EV Smart program. And I know Richie and his team have identified, you know, transportation electrification is one of the key areas for the GMI report. And then there were two others, enabling the resilient grid and activating energy transformations. Other than those three pieces, is there anything that you think should sort of be on the table for consideration as another major trend happening right now?
Can somebody take a minute to explain what the other two mean? Because I'm not sure I fully understand what you mean by those two.
Sure, Richie, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, and so from a resiliency standpoint, Susan, I think what we've noticed is there, as far as GMI is concerned, it's been difficult getting data that really outlines resiliency. I think it's hard to kind of describe what resiliency means from questions within that data set. So we're trying to talk to utilities more about how are they defining resiliency. And so if certainly there is a trend on the public side or even inside of, you know, different state legislatures, whether it's Florida or North Carolina, that are trying to begin to tackle that definition, how can we help explain the story from a utility standpoint or a grid operation standpoint? And so just it's more of a messaging point of, you know, from CenterPoint Energy, what have they done after Harvey and how are they addressing, you know, the needs of the next kind of issue that might come through. So it's it's trying to better define resiliency from a grid standpoint. And that's kind of what we're looking for. So far, Duke and CenterPoint Energy and APS is going to talk more about that.
Okay, because, you know, that is an important piece. I think, you know, you put your finger on it in that it's really hard to define resiliency. A lot of the investments that have been made in grid modernization over time may have been made with the intention of doing X, but they additionally have a benefit of improving resiliency. So, you know, if you look at something like AMI, you know, the installation of AMI, you've got the benefit of it that it facilitates energy efficiency programs, it facilitates better customer information, it facilitates the long run ability of customers to install DERs on their homes and so forth, but it also has a massive resiliency impact in that it allows for much more situational awareness. And so I think it's hard when you talk about that one to kind of, you might want to go with a bit more specificity in terms of what are you looking for. I mean, I know one of the big trends right now and something that Exelon is super interested in and that it would be great to have GridWise focus on a bit, and I know it's one of the primary, tenants that is going to be informing EEI's activities both at the national and at the state levels over the next year in 2020, is this idea that regardless of whether you call what's going on climate change or just more severe weather for whatever reason, there is probably a need to evolve the standards to which we build and maintain stuff. And so this idea of advancing more modern standards, working through the various standard setting organizations for the standards that would be applied to buildings, but then also applied to the energy infrastructure, such that when we go to a commission and ask to make significant investments for resiliency, we could point to a new standard that informs kind of our decisions about replacing poles for ones that have higher wind tolerance, doing substation hardening and flood mitigation and things like that. So I know there's a lot going on in that space. That's not something that I necessarily think you can measure on GMI for immediately, but I would think it's something you should be start looking to. And I guess my question also is that's, I think, going to be a primary focus in resiliency over the course of the next year. But I think a lot of that's going to be happening at the national level. But then has to be this recognition that those national standards need to be modified regionally to take into consideration the different resiliency challenges that different parts of the country have. So that was a big mouthful there, but I don't know how you capture that concept, but I know it's an area that we're very interested in.
No, that's really helpful. I think, you know, even with the DSP white paper here and kind of even kind of addressing the non-wires alternatives, I think altogether, Susan, what we're looking to do with this GMI is really just to bring up the topics that are important, evolving standards. That could certainly be a part of this GMI. I don't think we're looking to get all of the answers here. What the goal is if we're identifying these three trends and putting a little more specificity to them, that allows us to change the questions for GMI next year. So we'll be getting back into the data set. Let's remove things on, you know, if it's AMI or things that are maybe less important or are not telling the picture the right way. This is kind of our kind of soft launch of how we're going to change some of the questions we're going to be asking our utilities and our states. And so hopefully we're starting to develop that context around resiliency and then refine it better with a better question set or a more efficient question set and start to try to get some data. So
in that context, maybe let me take on finding a way in a very short way to articulate this idea of the need for evolving and modernizing the standards, impacting building and also grid resiliency, what the targets are in recognition of new environmental climate phenomena. You know, you don't want to make it political by talking climate change, but by being able to say, you know, and I'll find some language and then maybe send that to you, because I do think that's a really important trend to start looking for. Like I said, I don't think it's necessarily as much on the state level as it may be on the regional level, but it could be on the state level. I mean, I'm sure Florida has evolved their standards for building and so forth, and I think we need to start just capturing that, because I think it becomes, it underpins a lot of the actions the utilities are likely to take in resilience. So I'll take that on as defining, helping you guys work through how to put that in there.
Let's coordinate offline, Susan. We're going to most likely have a handful, kind of like the white paper that we just had, of call out boxes, and even half a one page kind of stories, if you will. And so if one of them needs to be more focused on this type of resiliency or looking at it from a standards point of view, I think that's great. So we'll have opportunity for that.
Kind of on the same front, and is putting in there also some way to capture the idea, and I know this is close to Steve and the conversations he's been having with Bruce, some way to capture the notion of states bringing more flexibility to how they interface with IOUs in the awarding of federal dollars for pre-event mitigation and post-event recovery. I don't think that's, like, again, I don't think that's necessarily something you're going to see evidence of immediately in GMI, but we ought to start putting that out there as something that, you know, an advanced state will be thinking more in a more complex way about how to interact with the grid providers in their state on accessing federal mitigation and recovery funds. So we'll find a way to maybe capture that one too for a call out.
Great. I think it's good. I think this first section of where we're setting the stage might be a good place for that. We're certainly talking about how different states are, you know, using different kinds of rate plans and things like that for performance incentive based regulation. And I think there's certainly opportunities to kind of expand that scope, but we don't want to get too broad. But yeah, I think let's talk about, you know, what are the most important ones to hit on for resiliency, and I think we can tackle that over the next few months.
Okay.
And likewise, I know we're coming up at the end of our time here, but just on that third part, it was kind of a catch-all, Susan. It was, you know, we realized that resiliency is a huge thing, and that electrification, transportation of either ports or beneficial electrification, those are two obvious ones. The third one's kind of a catch-all. Whether it's Duke is going to talk a little bit more about what they've learned over the last few years of kind of the whole grid improvement plan and where it stands now. It's kind of like a, you know, how are some of these states taking a very broad approach or working all together, and how do we kind of capture the stories from that? Because, you know, that has not been captured in the index, and North Carolina's moved forward. Virginia is now moving forward. You know, how do we capture some of these kind of more broader advancements? If it's, you know, the executive group is communicating and working well with the utilities or not, what can we bring to light? What kind of insights can we glean from that kind of more broader picture? And that's kind of the energy transformation idea of it.
Well, I think on the energy transformation one, you might want to also try to find a way to capture the concept of what states are starting to allow for new revenue mechanisms that incent or at least hold unharmed utilities for, you know, this whole CapEx, OpEx. I mean, set it up so that when, you know, that is one of our goals for 2020, is this idea of new mechanisms for utility revenue that recognize that it's no longer just a sell energy and make investment world. It's also a world where the utility serves as a platform for a variety of other people's investments and services and so forth. So that's another one that I think falls into that big catch-all. But we ought to make sure that the GMI, when we're laying out this year in the GMI, things that we're going to be trying to actually count or value in the next round, we reflect in that the things we've set are our four priorities for areas of focus in 2020.
And that's exactly right. I agree. I think, yeah, if we can have kind of abstract or setting the stage for those things that we want to work on in 2020, you'll see the Technology Council, parallel to the Policy Council that we have going on, is also going to be talking about some of the technology things. Maybe standards is one of them. So we're trying to unite everybody. That's what the goal is at Grid Connect, is to bring kind of all those groups together at that members meeting and get more regular meetings of both of those groups in 2020. So, yeah, I think you're right. Coordinating and putting that all together, GMI should certainly bridge that for the whole year.
Yeah, and if we're saying it's our priority, we ought to be measuring the state to see if we're actually achieving anything on those priorities.
We are looking to produce this by the end of January. Ideally,
right.
It might be distributed. Probably our fallback will be NARUC meetings that second week of February. So I don't know if we can chew off everything, but certainly we should have an idea of what has to be in here. And so let's work with that, and let's work with the Policy Council on that too, Susan, and
okay.
Making sure that we get everything in here that needs to be in here. Well, I've got 2 minutes or 3 minutes to the hour. I think we've captured everything that I was hoping to capture. Jenna, did you have anything else to add, or Chris or Susan, any last comments?
I have nothing to add except my appreciation for everyone's time.
No, I don't think I have anything else to add, but if you have any questions along the way or you need any more details or information, just reach out and let me know.
Yeah, I'm
good
as well. Let's catch up on those couple of outstanding items offline.
Perfect. Will do, Susan. I'll reach out to you. Well, thank you, everybody.
All right.
Yeah, thanks everyone for your time. Safe travels, Susan, back home, and safe travels, Jenna, back home, and we'll be in touch, Chris.
All right,
sounds good.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.